this because you want it to continuously rotate. And then, of course, you have the problem of making a rotary joint, which for me is kind of easy because I've been making rotary transformers for VTRs and stuff like that for years. It's not such a big deal to do it 2 meters of UHF either.
Now, you gave me a little hint about this earlier. You want it to act like a lighthouse, so you want an antenna that rotates in azimuth. I guess a lighthouse rotates something like, what, 3 or 4 rotations per minute. So you want a high directivity beam rotating in azimuth. And by the way, a lighthouse usually has a simultaneous beam at one instant of time. It's putting out a beam at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and the two of them rotate 3 or 4 revolutions per minute. Is that the thing you're trying to do? Because I've got some other hints for you. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Well, you're thinking about spitting out. I'm thinking about taking in, okay? You know, actually, lighthouses have these real intricate Fresnel lenses that do an amazing job. And they also have these little facets that actually direct a little bit of light in a different direction. Actually, your friend of mine, Bill Baker, actually, he just won an award to his lighthouse up in Newfoundland. Oh, no, it's Prince Edward Island, sorry. That's where it is. But anyway, the idea is to take that, put it into a receiver, detect the envelope of the signal, send that into a A to D, and then do some quenching.
Roughly how fast do you want to rotate it? And are you attempting to do an RDF function? Is that what's going on here, Eric?
Ultimately, that's one of the applications. There's some other interesting things that require a sweeping beam. In the case, we'll actually be sending out a pulse on 2 meters and listening for it coming back.
Sounds like it's a radar. Now, I guess you could say, to make it legal, you're transmitting high-speed Morse code dots, and you're doing a testing procedure. In reality, we're not allowed to run radar below the 10 gigahertz band, Eric, go ahead.
I know, but I'm not thinking of this as radar. There's another person in mind, I have to think about that before I make a response, because you never know who's listening.
Roger, Dodger, you and I should have some more conversations on this, because I've been down some of these roads and I've got some suggestions for you. But the kind of directivity that you want requires real estate. And real estate on VHF, UHF frequencies, it's going to require a fair amount of a metal up in the air. But there's ways of making that metal, gravity balance, wind balance, and there's ways of rotating at 360 degrees at a pretty high rate.
I'll put it inside a radome.
You can put it inside of a radome, but at VHF, UHF frequencies, in order to get the directivity you want, you're talking about booms like 20 feet long. You don't want to make a 20-foot diameter radome and suffer that amount of wind loading on the top of the tower. You don't need the radome.
Extreme height.
The radome gives you protection from weather. Your antenna can be built out of the right materials, so it doesn't need protection from weather. Why do you think you need a radome?
I don't. It just happens to be a very big radome where I'm thinking about doing this. And it's there already, so.
Okay, take advantage of the radome that you don't have to build. Sounds good. And this radome, does it happen to be located at the TEI? Go ahead.
It has to be located what?
At Prince Edward Island.
No. This happens to be upstate. It's just an experiment that a friend and I, we came up with an idea and we want to try it.
Okay. The main spark plug behind the group that operates from Mount Greylock every year on the VHF contest, he has a local radome that he has used very often. Are you hooking up with him?
This is an old AT&T site that somebody else owns. We have the opportunity to play, so we're going to play.
That's a fun site. Wes, I think you had a question. question on the subject. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yes, actually, I have another question. I have a subject to discuss, which is related to antenna and to magnetron, to rocket engine, all together in one. So I thought when we start space report, we might not have a time for it. So it's good for either the portion of the antenna discussion or the portion of the space report. And the second subject that I have is Lexus has announced a hoverboard, like a rollerboard, but hoverboard based on liquid nitrogen, and it doesn't have a wheels. Both of the emails you've got. So, whatever you would like to discuss, and to issue.
I'm going to give you a couple of words right now. We've all seen these cryogenically cooled superconducting materials, high temperature superconductors that you cool with liquid nitrogen, that when you put them in the vicinity of a strong magnet, you do get a hover response. And you've seen people push on those where they can readjust the height and the system relocks itself into a new height. Look at that photograph of your particular hoverboard. You see a man putting his foot on the hoverboard. You do not see him putting his whole body weight on that hoverboard.
That's not true. I sent you a few emails, and in one of the emails you see the whole video, which actually show not only this stuff with the men on it on the ground, but also above the water, about 2 inches, 3 inches, no contact with the ground.
Okay. Do you believe in the photograph that it's not in the movie, that it's not phony, the man is putting his whole weight on that, and is this an 80-pound man, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Wes.
It's a good question. I hope Roy is going to join us, because he's got that email, also space report, for the space report I have that antenna engine stuff, magnetron, whatever. So, talking about the Lexus. Well, Lexus wants to make a money. Let me jump. So, we may say the Lexus is trying to attract the attention of the viewers by creating something that is funny. So Lexus might really have it. At first, when I got into it, I had some of the pictures that I have sent you, but also later on, I was digging, and immediately my group of people, they react within 5 minutes, sometimes 2 minutes. It's about 1 million people all around, most of them are in quick contact. They found within a few minutes the materials, the videos presented by Lexus. One of the emails that I have sent you was rejected, so you don't have probably the one that is with the clip showing a bunch of people on the something like a roller coaster, concrete playground, and plenty of people playing with that liquid nitrogen hover. Well, it's not a hover, it's a hoverboard. And yes, there is a person, at least 80 pounds, maybe 120 pounds, maybe 160 pounds, and it is hovering over not only the cement, but also hovering over the water. Roy was able to respond to it, and he said, which I agree with you, Roy. Well, you're going to have the contra standing or contra, I'm missing the word, the magnetic field. When you look at that experiment with the frozen magnetic field flux, you're going to understand that there must be a presence of either something like electromagnetic field from the coils beneath the concrete, or you have to have a railing that is creating the electromagnetic field, then you have a hovering. But maybe Roy would be able to join us with that. And then later on we go to antenna jet engine for space way, are you with us?
We're running a little bit late, and I'm going to go over to the mailbag right now. KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John.
Can't believe K2UPS.
That's right, I forgot that. K2UNCLE PAPA SIERRA. Go ahead, Rich. K2RW in the TechNet. Sorry, I forgot about you. And what town are you near tonight, Rich? Okay, maybe Rich is not available right now. John, KC2WGB, K2RW, are you there, John?
KC2WGB, yes, I am, Dick. Yeah, K2UPS had some information on that antenna that Rich was talking about, but maybe he'll come in later, maybe he stopped to eat or something. Okay, let me pick up my notes, we'll go to the mailbag. Very good. All right, we'll take the first question and we'll check and see if Rich is out there. All right. Have a young gentleman who has listened to you speak about your actual measurements in millivolts and microvolts of S signals. So he'd like to know, where can he, in the receiver, where does he have to go? What kind of meter does he have to hook up? How is that done? And he understands it's only going to be relative to his reception and his antennas and all that, but he just wants to know basically how to hook up a voltmeter so he can do what you were doing. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, some of this is going to be a little bit laughable by current standards. This was way back in the dark ages of, let me think now, 1975. 1970, yeah. Way back in the dark ages of 1970, I was using a AR3 receiver, a tube receiver, tuned from 80 through 10 meters, and I was using the 40-meter band, 7 to 7.5 megahertz, as the tunable IF for my 432 converter. My converter converted from 432 down to 7 megacycles. As I scanned across 7 megacycles, I was really scanning from 432 to 432.4, so to speak. But a tube-type receiver, well-made tube-type receivers, do have a automatic gain control circuit, automatic volume control circuit, AVC. Good news is that it produces something like very close to 0 volts with a 0 signal in there. And when the signal gets real strong, I think the voltage went to something like minus 5 volts. The way the receiver worked is that the final detecting tube, the 6AEL5 as I remember, let me drop it. I think that 6AEL5 was a triode or pentode tube combined with a pair of diodes. The pair of diodes was the full-wave rectifier at the tail end of the IF strip. So as the signal got real strong in the IF strip, that rectifier rectified a nice strong voltage. The strong voltage was rectified as a negative voltage. The negative voltage was fed to the first or second tube way up front in the receiver to the control grid. As you put negative voltage on the control grid, the gain of the tube went down. Therefore, you're tending to keep the voltage, the signal strength in the IF strip stays the same. You don't overload the IF strip because as the signal gets strong, you're putting a more and more negative voltage into those early tubes and you're cutting back their gain, automatic volume control. Before that was invented by, I think it was the Sperry company way back in the dark ages, people used to have problems of tuning the receiver from a weak radio broadcast station to a strong one, and all of a sudden the audio coming out of the loudspeaker would blast you if you didn't have this automatic volume control. So it became a very convenient thing that became a patented idea, and I think Sperry collected quite a bit of money on that patent over the years. Let me drop. So by putting a very high impedance vacuum tube voltmeter on that voltage, so you're not disturbing it, I made myself a graph of how many volts represented how many microvolts of signal going into the receiver, into the 432 converter. And that microvolts going in and actually DBM, which is the equivalent, was done with a Hewlett Packard 608 signal generator that I borrowed from AIL on weekends, brought it home and used it to calibrate my receiver. So I had a chart on the wall, X number of volts out of the vacuum tube voltmeter connected to that AVC line in that receiver, gave me X number of microvolts going into my total converter system. So that was the chart for calibration, and it wasn't traceable to the bureau. I probably had 10% or 5% error on certain portions of that range, but it was good enough. When a guy made a change to his antenna or the tight height of his radio tower, and he would now call me up and said, "Hey, Dick, how many microvolts am I giving you today?" And I would tell him how many extra microvolts. Therefore, he knew that he's got 3 dB more gain, 6 dB more gain, or 5 dB more signal strength, so to speak. Let me drop. Now, even with solid-state receivers, almost all modern-day receivers have an automatic volume control circuit in them. So somewhere there is a voltage in the receiver that you can tap into that becomes more negative as the signal becomes stronger into the receiver. Most receivers operate that way. And you can't do this with a volt-ohm milliammeter. The triplet Simpson volt-ohm milliammeters, which had 20,000 ohms per volt, and I'm using the 3-volt scale, so you're getting a 60,000 ohms. That's a huge amount of loading to a tube-type automatic volume control voltage circuit. That circuit operates at probably at least a million ohms of impedance, so you don't want to load it down, which stops the receiver from working correctly. So in those days, it had to be a vacuum tube voltmeter. They happened to be a Heathkit V7 vacuum tube voltmeter. Nowadays, your digital voltmeters, they all have a 10 mega ohm input impedance. By the way, the vacuum tube voltmeters all had a 10 mega ohm input impedance, which is extremely light loading on that AVC line. So by finding, by way of the schematic diagram, where is the voltage for the AVC circuit, automatic volume control circuit of your receiver, and you put an extra connector into the wall of that receiver. Let me drop it. So now with your external meter, you can sense that voltage, and if you want to be super damn conservative about it, you put an extra transistor in there acting as an emitter follower. The nice thing about an emitter follower, or if you want to use FET transistors, it's going to be a source follower. Either of those circuits can easily have an input impedance of many, many mega ohms, and yet to have an output impedance that's quite small, so that any kind of a voltmeter can be connected there, and you wouldn't be loading down the circuit. So you're really building a buffer amplifier. There's ways by which you can put a operational amplifier in there as a voltage follower, and you can have a many, many mega ohm input impedance if you hook it up correctly. So worry about whether or not you're loading down the circuit. If so, be willing to put an extra a buffer amplifier in there. But monitoring that voltage and then using a known calibrated signal generator plugged into the front end of your receiver system, and now you put various signal strengths in there, measure that voltage, plot it as a chart, and now you've got a way of giving those kinds of readings to people. And so of the 450 or so people I used to talk to on 432, where I had a 3x5 card file, let me drop it. I had a card for each one of those guys that I talked to on 432, because they were kind of rare animals way back in those days. And I would write down on that card, on this date I measured X number of microvolts from W2XYZ, so to speak. And so those guys would have me refer back to that from time to time as they made changes. And it was very interesting to see the fact that the guys whose 2-meter and 432 antennas cleared the trees, if their antenna cleared the trees, they would have almost the same strength summer, winter, spring, and fall. The guys whose antennas were below tree level, they got weaker in the summertime, and right after a rain when there's water on those leaves, boy, did their signal get weak. And that's a beautiful way of seeing the fact that wet leaves on 432 are very good at absorbing RF signals, obvious by a much smaller number of microvolts I would get from those guys that time of year. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Have that guy ask him to, after he hooks up his signal strength meter, which by the way is a more accurate S meter on the receiver, so to speak. You get with an external digital voltmeter, you can get much more accurate readings. So have him give us a feedback when he does that, letting us know how well it worked. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW the TechNet.
W2YY.
Sounds like you got a question on this one, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, I actually do have a question on this. When you measured people talking to you on 432, they were using sideband mode, correct? Not a CW carrier. So if they did this from day to day to day, couldn't their voice characteristic give them slightly more, slightly less power at different times to give you a different reading at different times? Back to you.
In 1970, in the dark ages, I started doing this in 1968 to be exact. The number of guys who had sideband capability then was about 3%. The majority of guys in those days were getting on 432 by way of a crystal diode, by way of a varector diode multiplier assembly. And they could put out Morse code, they could put out FM modulation, and some of them tried doing AM, but it sounded kind of ratty. But in those days, single sideband was pretty rare. Nowadays, as long as you've got the right kind of a fast attack peak detecting circuit, I could measure the peak amplitude of a guy's sideband signal with that technique. I just require a little bit more circuitry into that digital voltmeter, and that's the way I would do it today. So what I used to do, when I had this array of 16 Yagis, you can see the picture of that on Mike number 2 site, mybocktechnet.com. You'll see a picture of me standing in the middle of an array of 16 Yagis. In order to aim that antenna at somebody on 432 when they're transmitting sideband, you can't use the signal strength meter, peak detecting one maybe. You had to use your hearing. Let me drop it. By cranking down the RF gain control on the receiver, so I'm only hearing the peaks of his audio from single sideband, and then swishing the antenna back and forth, the human hearing system listening to single sideband voice can very easily pick out the direction where you get the maximum peak of the voice. When you turn off the ABC circuit and you're listening to a weak sideband because you turned down the RF gain, in the case of a sideband signal, when you've got a fast attack, slow decay, automatic volume control circuit on the receiver, and now you're trying to watch that S meter and you're trying to figure out, as the guy is talking with sideband, which way to aim the antenna, you'll never get it. It takes forever. But by doing it with human hearing, by bypassing the ABC, I was very easily able to do it. When I had the antenna peaked on him, I could hear him suck wind when he was talking and he's inhaling, if you know what I mean. Whereas by audio, I could easily tell when the antenna was aimed in the right direction. W2RYY, does that make sense? K2RIW, detect that?
Makes perfect sense to me. What I should ask you really is a qualifying question. What mode are they using, CW, AM, or FM? Which would give you more of a steady carrier relative from day to day.
Each one of those guys wanted the microvolt reading to be as high as he could get. So he would go over to the key down mode with maximum power output, and he would do that for 15 seconds while I measured his microvolts. They wanted to know what's the peak they could get. So what kind of modulation they would use when they're sending me audio, it wasn't a function, Joe, go ahead.
Okay, very good. That answers my question.
You've got it, Sean. KC2WGB with mailbag number 2, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Take after John gets in the mailbox number 2. See if Rich is back. I'm curious. And so are you.
Let's try right now. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. If you're there, Rich. K2RIW, the TechNet. If not, with some delay, you pick it up, John. I'm guessing he's on a lunch break. You got it, John.
2WGB. Okay, yeah, we'll try him again after this one. You know that gentleman that's looking to measure his microvolts, I believe what he's doing with that is he's listening to beacons and making fine improvements to antennas. see if it makes a difference. I believe that's what he's trying to do. So I'm sure he'll have some fun with that. But that was a good description for him. All right, I'll let it drop and I'll go on to the next one.
You got to be a bit careful with that one. I've listened to lots of beacons over the years without me making any change to my system. From day to day, I could easily get a beacon that's 20 dB stronger one day and below threshold the next day. Unless it's a beacon that's 5 miles away from you. Mother Nature's propagation goes up and down really fierce. On VHF, UHF, even on 10 gigs, that beacon transmitter they had at Princeton University, at Princeton, New Jersey, there were days when it was 20 dB over my noise, and there were days when it was below my threshold. So unless you integrate the signal that you get from a beacon for a whole lot of different days, and you do some kind of averaging the results, it's not easy to make a measurement of your receiver system by way of listening to a beacon at some reasonable amount of range. The only way you can really get around that is to find some guy essentially within line of sight of you. And there, the number of variables Mother Nature can create drastically gets cut down. It doesn't go to zero. Let me drop. The top of your tower and the top of your buddy's tower are 5 miles away. With two of you on top of the tower with binoculars, you can see each other. Double damn sure you got line of sight. And even under those conditions, measure beacon signal strength from day to day, you're going to see variation. Because whenever you transmit a signal, it touches every single thing in your environment. You think you've aimed the antenna to the west, and you think the signal is only going to the west. Oh boy. Although the signal is weaker to the north and the south and the east, you're sending signals to all of those directions at once. And depending on whether or not the leaves are wet, depending on whether or not the water tower is leaning an eighth of a wavelength on 10 gigahertz over to one side because the sun is shining on that side of the water tower. And therefore the reflection you're getting off the water tower, yesterday was in phase and today it's out of phase. What I'm getting at is even under line of sight conditions, you run a strip shot recorder for 24 hours and you'll say, why in the world does that signal get stronger and weaker like that? How did Mother Nature do that? As the ground drives out, the amount of ground reflection changes. As the wind blows and the moisture in the air changes, even line of sight conditions, you run a strip shot recorder, you'll be amazed how much that signal goes up and down. Ain't nothing steady when it comes to propagation. Unless you've got two ends of a waveguide, and you're sending a signal into one end and listening out of the other end, that's going to be reliable. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. Well, I think what he's doing here is he's making long-term analysis because, you know, he showed me a few charts and things like that that he's making. So this will be over a long period of time. And maybe he has other favorite stations that are always on that he listens to and he knows their locations. So, hey, he's hunting and he's having fun. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, Dick, I have a young man here who's trying to understand the term octave and what it means in the radio frequencies. He's looking at 5 megahertz. He'd like to know what would be the second octave, third octave, how is that done, what are the steps, and is it a multiple of 8? He's a little confused on that, so maybe you could tell him what the second octave of 5 megahertz and how that's calculated. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Here I'm not sure, but I believe the word octave really came from musical instruments. You take a piano, and you take center C on the piano, and by way of the reference data for radio engineers, you can find out exactly what frequency that's on. I think the so-called international A, the note A in the middle of the piano, I think is 440 hertz. But I'm not positive on that. Maybe it's 600. But what I'm getting is the C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. Those are the main white keys on the piano. And when you go from the first C up to the next C, and you look at those exact frequencies, they differ by exactly 2-to-1. An octave is a 2-to-1 ratio. So a 5 megacycle signal second harmonic of that is 10 megacycles. Third harmonic is 15 megacycles. Fourth harmonic is 14, is 20 megacycles. So each harmonic is a 2-to-1 ratio. Let me double check that. Second harmonic, third harmonic, yes. And the way, that's harmonic. Be careful now. Harmonic and octave, two different things. Each octave is 2-to-1. Each harmonic is a simple multiple. Okay. Second harmonic would be 10 megs. Third harmonic would be 15 megs. One octave higher than 5 megacycles is 10 megacycles. Two octave higher is 20 megahertz. 5 megs up to 10, one octave. 10 megs up to 20 megs, another octave. 20 megs to 40 megs, another octave. So if you want to know the number of octaves, and you want to know it fractionally, somebody might ask you, hey, your basic crystal is on 5 megs. How many octaves is 17 megahertz? No, it's more than one, because one octave would be 10 megs. No, it's less than two.
Repeater, come out.
You know it's less than two octaves, because two octaves would be 20 megs. So you know it's somewhere between one octave and two octaves higher in frequency. 17 megs, what would it be? To mathematically find that out is you take the log of the ratio. You divide the frequency of interest by your reference frequency. Take the log of that. Then you take the log of the number 2. Divide the second number into the first number. That's the number of octaves. What you've really done by that process is you've boiled everything down to a logarithm base 2 when you do that two-step process. And let me actually do that in my calculator just to give you an example. So if my 5 megacycle oscillator is my reference, and somebody says, I'm looking at, by some means, my phase lock loop system is giving me a 17 megahertz signal. And 5 megs is my reference. How many octaves higher than that? 17 divided by 5 is 3.4. I'm going to take the log of 3.4. It's 0.5. I'm going to take the log of 2. It's 0.3. I divide one into the other. 1.765. So what I'm getting at is crazy multiples like that. What is 17 megacycles compared to a 5 megacycle reference? The answer is 1.765 octaves higher. But in general, octave means ratio of 2 to 1. So the first octave above 5 megs is 10 megs. The second octave above 5 megs is 20 megs. The third octave above 5 megs is 40 megs. Everything's by 2 to 1. Let me drop. The octave mathematics has got another very handy place. Antenna gain. If I'm stacking Yagis, and as you can tell, I eventually stacked 16 individual Yagis, but I had a switching network, which I called the Zoom control, where I could decide how many of those Yagis are active at any one time. Every time you double the number of antennas you're using, could say you're going up one octave in the total amount of antennas. You could say you're going up one octave in the total amount of gain, and you could say that each octave is 3 dB of increase. The bottom line is, as you're building a phased array, every time you double the number of antennas, you go up 3 dB in gain. You're going up one octave. So if I got one single Yagi and I stack another one above it, I've got 3 dB more gain. If I want 3 dB more gain, I've got to double the whole darn thing. I've got to go from 2 Yagis to 4 Yagis to get 3 dB more gain above the 2. You've got to double the number of antennas. You've got to double the amount of total effective area in order to go up one octave in gain, which is 3 dB more gain. So octave mathematics, a little bit crazy at first, but by doing that double log operation, you can now boil it down to an exact science with as many decimal places as you'd like. I wonder if you've ever heard that crazy piece of mathematics before, John. I think it's pretty rare. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. No charge for this one.
No, Dick. I've never heard that or even used it, but interesting. Now, the other question is, when we have a crystal we're going to use at its third overtone, is it the third octave?
not. Third overtone is the third harmonic. Gotta be careful now. There's a lot of difference between octave and harmonic. Harmonic is the number of times you have to multiply the base reference frequency to get the new frequency. If I've got a 5 megacycle crystal, and somebody asks me, what is 15 megacycles? It is the third harmonic. Somebody asks you, what is 10 megacycles? It is the second harmonic. If somebody asks you, what is the first harmonic? He's misunderstanding the mathematics. There is no first harmonic. First harmonic is the fundamental. So, you gotta, there are people who think that when you go from 5 megs to 10 megs, that's the first harmonic. Good common sense. That's not the way the mathematics works out. So you could say that the first harmonic is no harmonic at all. It's your reference. So be careful about harmonic versus octave. Octave is always a 2-to-1 ratio. Harmonic can be any ratio in the world. The 15th harmonic of 5 megacycles is what? 45 megacycles? Something like that. In other words, you take your new frequency that you care about, divide it by the fundamental, and that mathematics is the harmonic number. But it's not the octave number. The octave number, you've got to go through the double log process if you want it to be exact. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment on that.
KC2WGB, very good thing. I'm sure he's going to be totally confused now. But that's all right. We'll have fun. I'll let it drop. We'll see if Rich is out there. Maybe we can pick him up.
And I have a comment on that.
Okay, what's your comment on harmonics, Wes? Go ahead.
Just simple analogy. 1.8, 3.6, 7, 14, 28. Enter
Adrian. Yeah, there are some people that are very skilled at doing mental mathematics with logs, with octaves, and so on. But whatever your reference is, the very next step, you have to double it to go up an octave.
But those are ham radio bands for HF.
Yep. Each ham radio band happens to be essentially one octave up, 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters. 15 meters, though, is something in between. could say it's the, let me think now, 21 megs versus 7 megs. It's the third harmonic of 40 meters. 15 meters is the third harmonic of 40 meters, is one way of looking at it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, let's put a call out to K2UPS. Rich, if you're out there, pick it up.
Hey, John, K2UPS mobile. Yeah, I just got back in the truck again. I was on a break here in Pennsylvania. So I guess you saw my comment and told Vic that that's a variant of the folded dipole.
I was going to have you explain that, Rich.
So I think you're saying that the Cobra compact antenna is really a variant of a folded dipole.
Ooh.
Very, very cute. If that's what it is. Go ahead, Rich. And what town are you in, out of curiosity?
I just came out of Somerset, Pennsylvania, heading back to New York. But yeah, if you look at the diagram, I believe the website has some information on it. They show you it's not just like a simple fan dipole where the wires are all connected at the center connector and then they happen to be bundled together. There are actually connections along the length there. So that's why it seems like it was short on 80 meters.
Sounds like a very crafty design. And as long as you can fold it, put taps on it, loading coils, tap hat capacitors, zigzag, no matter what you do to a dipole-like antenna, and no matter how compact you make it, you're going to get within 5/10 of a dB the exact same gain as long as it hits resonance, as long as you've used low-loss materials that are not getting hot. It's a hard thing to believe. As I've given you guys an example so many times, a full 80-meter dipole on a 14-gauge wire is approximately 132 feet long. I could squeeze that dipole down to 32 feet. And if I put my antenna tuner with very wide tuning range right at the center of that dipole. That's 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. I've thrown away 100 feet of wire. I've now got roughly one-third the length of wire. The zillion guys out there who think you either got one-third or one-ninth the area when you did that, because the area's really got some length and some width to it. And therefore, they think you're going to lose 9 dB of gain, so to speak. Once you hit resonance, that super short antenna, it's going to be high in Q, it's going to be narrow in bandwidth, you're going to have to retune it every time you go up 10 KC. But still, it'll give you within 4/10 of a dB, 5/10 of a dB, the exact same gain. And then 5/10 of a dB of gain, let me drop. You think you lost 5/10 of a dB of gain. Even that is not real. When you shrunk the antenna down, your normal figure eight dipole pattern became a little bit fatter. It's aiming a little bit more signal off the side of the non-boresight directions. You didn't lose any of that signal. You just radiated in a slightly different direction. So there is no loss at all. Read that section out of Krause's book on antennas, McGraw-Hill 1950, a Bible in the antenna field, and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. You can shrink that dipole down as much as you want, as long as you've got a broad enough antenna matching network in there, and as long as you're using low-loss material. There is a catch, and that is, as the antenna gets shorter and shorter, the Q goes up. And Q has got about five characteristics. Center frequency divided by bandwidth. The bandwidth is going to become very narrow. You're taking a very small number and dividing it into a big number, and that's where your Q is. Your Q is going to tell you you've got a hell of a lot more narrow bandwidth. Q also tells you how much the voltage increases. If your Q went from 10 to 100, whatever voltage you had at the tip of the dipole just got 10 times stronger in voltage. Whatever current you had in the center just got 10 times stronger. Q is a voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, center frequency divided by bandwidth, rise time and fall time. There's a whole bunch of definitions of Q. They're all the exact same phenomena, just different ways of measuring. So as you make the dipole shorter and shorter, eventually you get to the point where you're going to arc it over, if you know what I mean. The voltage on the tips is so high, you're going to create lightning between the tips. There have been a couple of guys, there have been a couple of guys who put a short 80-meter whip antenna on the automobile with a great big loading coil and a fancy antenna tuner, and they're putting a couple of hundred watts into it, and at nighttime, they see the sparks coming off the tip of the antenna, and as they listen to those sparks, when the guy is transmitting sideband audio, you can hear his audio in those sparks. That's a beautiful definition, a beautiful demonstration of the fact that a short antenna that's electronically short in wavelengths, but yet re-resonated, is going to give you higher Q. That really means higher voltage, higher current, and the works, and narrower bandwidth. So, sounds like you've done some nice things on this one, Rich. I wonder if you've known people who have actually used that antenna Rich is about to use. K2UPS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, I have not used that one myself. I know some people who had it, got pretty good results with it. You know, you could probably make it yourself if you had the stuff for a lot less than what they're selling it for, but for most of us, it's more convenient to buy it pre-made. It's an interesting design, and they do work when they're put up right and away from, like any other antenna, you want to try to keep it away from the metal objects, you know, either poles in the yard or gutters, that sort of stuff, and you should have good results with it, so hopefully it works out. KTUPS.
Good information, Rich, and thank you. KC2WTB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Small and everything drop, KC2WTB. Very good. Okay, this is the last one. This is very confusing, but this gentleman has a dipole up. He's operating at 40 meters. He had a 4-to-1 ballon on it, and he could only get 3-to-1. Best match, his tuner could just about do it. What he did, kept the 4-to-1 ballon there, he's tried so many things, and he added a 1-to-1 ballon before it. And not with the balance. He tried 2 4-to-1 balance. He could not get it any better than 3-to-1. So your thoughts on that, Dick? KC2WGB.
This sounds a little bit close to that email that I mailed you, Rich. John, I mailed you a copy of it. I'm trying to remember who else I mailed a copy. The original guy who asked the question. In this particular case, the guy was using 450 ohm ladder line. He didn't tell me what the transmission line is. He's got a dipole. Right now he's got unknown transmission line. Could be 50 ohm, could be 70 ohm, could be 400, could be 600 ohm ladder line, could be even 300 ohm twin lead. And there is, by the way, a 72 ohm twin lead, which is very rare stuff.
He's using a coax stick. He's got RG 400. He's got LMR 400 running up.
Okay. When he added the 1-to-1 balun, did he add it at the top of the antenna or in the shack? Big difference. Over to you.
Right at the upper end, he has the 4-to-1 right at the antenna, and right below that, maybe another 6 inches down, he's got the 1-to-1 balun.
Now, most 1-to-1 balans have two wing nuts as the output connectors. Most balans have a coax connector on the input. Now, how do you believe he connected the 1-to-1 balun with the wing nuts into the 4-to-1 balun with the coaxial connector input? Maybe he put a jumper piece of coax cable in there. What do you think, John? Go ahead.
I believe you're right, Dick. I believe he took those two wing nuts, attached two wires to that, put that on a 239 connector, and stuck it into the 4-to-1. That's what it looks like in the picture.
Now, the so-called 4-to-1, think about that. There's a lot of different ways of building a 4-to-1. In the most ideal situation, the 4-to-1 would be a real primary and secondary winding transformer on a toroid-like thing. In other words, the output of the 4-to-1 would be a thoroughly floating secondary winding, in which case he's really getting a balancing action as well as impedance matching action. You and I can also buy a 4-to-1 impedance matching transformer, and for reasons of people smearing the language, they may call it a balun. It may be a 4-to-1 impedance matching device. It might not be a balun. I could take one single winding, and by using different taps on that primary winding, I could make a 4-to-1 impedance match, but that is not a balun. The reason I'm saying this is, let me drop it. In the ideal world, you must feed that dipole in a thoroughly balanced manner. If at one instant of time you're putting positive 10 volts on the right side of the dipole, you must put negative 10 volts on the left side of the dipole during that half cycle of the sine wave. Equal voltage, opposite polarity on each side of the dipole at every instant of time. That's the thoroughly balanced way of feeding the dipole.
Dick, quick explanation of these balans. They're both wound as separate coils, so as two isolation transformers from the diagram. I can't tell from the picture, but the diagram that he drew is showing two isolation transformers.
Okay, if that's true, then adding the 1-to-1 balun to that system should have done nothing, with one slight exception, is changing the apparent length of the transmission line. But other than that, it should have done nothing. And if the 4-to-1 device, which is connected to the dipole, really has a primary and secondary winding that are thoroughly isolated, it's not an auto transformer. It really is a completely separate primary and secondary of good design. And that secondary winding, unless it's got a whole lot of straight capacitance to the primary winding, it could have been bipolar wound. If it's bipolar wound, you can have a lot of straight capacitance between the primary winding and the secondary winding. If I've got a toroid transformer, where the upper half of the toroid between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock is my secondary winding, and my primary winding is wound between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock. If they're really separate from each other, they're isolated. But an awful lot of these toroids are wound in a trifolar manner, in which there's a huge amount of stray capacitance between the primary winding and the secondary winding. By way of your ohmmeter, let me drop. By way of your ohmmeter, which is running at DC, you'll think that the primary winding and the secondary winding are thoroughly isolated from each other. But if now you have the AC equivalent of an ohmmeter operating at, say, 3.5 megacycles, where you can now really sense, well, there's another way of doing it. I can take the two leads of the secondary winding and short them together. Take the two leads of the primary winding and short them together. Now measure the capacitance between the two. If you really have completely separate windings, I should measure only a couple of picofarads. If they're really a trifilar winding, a quadrifilar winding, or a bifilar winding, I'm going to measure a couple of hundred picofarads, which merely means the secondary winding, although it is DC-wise isolated, RF-wise it could be heavily coupled to that primary winding, in which case that device is a 4-to-1 impedance match, and it may call itself a balun, it might not be a balun. So if he looks at those windings, are they bifilar wound? Big factor here. In which case, now the 1-to-1, which really does give isolation, would make a huge difference. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I can only go by his drawing. It looks like simple, straight wound, no bifilar windings. I'm not sure, but there is a possibility, because he tried several 4-to-1 balance, and they all gave basically the same thing. The fact that he added a 1-to-1, he only has one, so maybe there's something different or something defective in the 1-to-1, which is helping him out. But I'm going to write him and ask him if he's sure that they're simple isolation transformers. Doesn't sound right, because I agree with you. I don't think it should make any difference.
Well, there's something else going on here. A 4-to-1 is going to multiply 50 ohms up to 200. If I now take a 200 ohm output impedance of that 4-to-1 device, connect it to a 72 ohm dipole, right there I've got the, look at my calculator, I've got a reasonably high visual right there. 200 ohms divided by 72 is what I'm about to do. And that's the, whoops, did it wrong. 200, enter, 72, divide. That's an almost 3-to-1 visual right there. So, 2 points.
That's exactly what he's measuring with just the 4-to-1 balun, by the way.
That's exactly what it should measure. And now, adding a 1-to-1 should not have made much of a change to that, if it really is a balun. And, if the 4-to-1 is truly a balun with separate windings without a lot of straight capacitance between the two, the fact that the 1-to-1 added now took his 3-to-1 down to, I think he said 1.15, that is mysterious. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, I will make an inquiry, maybe next week I'll have an answer on that, maybe he can come up with something in the meantime, but I think we should go over to Paul. I'm sure he's got a lot of information. Great as usual. And we'll have fun. Back to you, Dick. KC2 WGB. By the way, Steve sent me a photograph that he sent to you about that antenna, that NMO. Now I understand exactly what it looks like. Perfect picture.
Yeah, KD2HUC. He sent you a copy of it, too. Yeah. He went and took that picture for us tonight and mailed it to us. What took so long? That's a joke. Well done. You guys are very well equipped with cameras and good ways of coupling it into your computer network and sending it. I don't have that ability. I do, but I don't know how to do it yet. That's not my strength. Paul, is anything happening in space? That's a joke. WS2N, K2RIW. Tell us a little bit about space, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Well, we always start off, I guess, with Voyager. And Voyager 2 just clicked over to 100, well, it's 108. Next, probably within about another month or two, it'll be 109 AU. But Voyager 1, we're still at 132. Every year that goes by, there's about a half an AU difference, too. which is always always interesting. But Voyager 1 is the one that's furthest away. So we'll probably wait a couple of years before Voyager 2 gets to what they consider the outside of the solar system. Not gravitationally, but, you know, with all the ions and everything. Solar wind. We have a launch coming up to the International Space Station. Supplies are going to be going up there on a Japanese rocket, the H-2. And that'll be launched next Sunday. I think I'll announce that anyway, because that'll be before the net. That's 9 o'clock, like 9:01 in the morning. And it'll be launched from Japan. And they have a rocket with over 500,000 pounds thrust. It's a hydrogen, oxygen rocket. They've been using that quite a while now. And this is their fifth launch to the space station with the H-2 cargo vessel. It carries quite a bit of cargo, a lot more than Progress does. So they'll be happy to get all that stuff up there, food and clothes, plenty of supplies, because they're really down overall in the last year. They're down three flights last October. We had the failure of the Orbital Science Antares Cygnus launch, and that was followed by the failed Progress launch. I believe that was in April, and then another month after that you had the launch of the Falcon 9, which blew up once it got to the maximum Q, you know, about a minute and a half or so into the flight. So we'll see how they do. Like to see that go up successfully. They're trying to accelerate the launches for the Progress. They're trying to push that earlier. In fact, I mentioned Orbital Science with the Antares Cygnus. They don't have the Antares new engines ready yet. That won't be until next year. So they contracted with United Launch Alliance, that's Boeing and Lockheed, to launch on an Atlas V, and originally planned for December. I think they might push that up a little earlier. They have it encapsulated in a 4-meter diameter fairing on top of the Atlas V, and that's what, you know, that's how they're going to do it. Just got delivered. It's actually manufactured in Italy, and you know, for Orbital Science. So maybe they'll get back on track. We'll see what happens next year if they can get their Antares launching again. That's the one I like, because they launch from Virginia, not too far from here. And then another launch. It just went over real quick last week. By the military, it's the MUOS. It'll be the fourth launch of this system, and I can't really mention every flight that goes up, but when I see something like this with a big diameter antenna on board, naturally my antennas go up when I see that. It's over an 18-meter dish antenna, so you're looking at a over 60 foot diameter. When I think about that, you know, it's the diameter, it's bigger than the length of my house. So that thing's got to unfurl and be put in geosynchronous orbit. And the Navy, it's primarily for the Navy. They'll be able to use almost cellular type of equipment to work the satellites, you know, either video data or whatever. So, that's amazing that they have these big antennas up there. So it's good to see. I think weighs like 15,000 pounds, you know, half of its fuel. And that will also be launched on an Atlas rocket, you know, Atlas Centaur rocket out of Cape Kennedy. Next science type of mission I'm looking forward to is actually beginning of next year, and that'll be the InSight mission to Mars. That's a landing mission, and that will be launched from a rocket in Vandenberg Air Force Base.